A very long story behind the fourth piano concerto. The version that's just been heard was from 1926. It was only played a couple of times by Rachmaninoff. The reviews weren't particularly kind, for various reasons that I suppose we could talk about, but rather than sort of persevering with the work, he immediately set about making changes. And another version came from 1928, which was published, but that didn't really find success either. And so he struggled. I think he recognized that there was good music in there and that something was wrong with its form. I think that's what he thought. And amazingly, you know, this work covered almost half of his life. It was only 2 years before his death that he created a third version from 1941, which also was published, and that's the version that everybody knows. And until the 1970s, I don't think anybody was really aware of this earlier version still existing. Rachmaninoff, rather wisely, I think, didn't change his manuscript of the first version, and he kept it. And after his death, it was donated to the Library of Congress, which is where it was found. And it was published in 2001, I think. So it's only been really in the public domain again for a decade or so. And this is the first time it's been heard in Australia.
When was the first time it was heard overseas, after 2001, when it was sort of, you know, released again or found again?
Well, Vladimir Ashkenazy conducted a recording with a great Russian pianist, Alexander Gindin, and that recording was released at the time of the publication. Although I understand there was to be some performances of it, I understand, in New York, which might have been a bit of a launch, but I understand that didn't go ahead for some reason that I can't recall. I know that there's another Russian pianist who's played it a little bit, but it's one of those rarities. I mean, the fourth piano concerto in comparison to the second and the third piano concerto, and even the Rhapsody on the theme of Paganini, it's a different work. You know, the funny thing about it is that even though it dates from 1926, it's clear that he had composed a lot of it, maybe even most of it, in his head soon after the third piano concerto, in his time before he left Russia. But the Soviet Revolution of 1917 changed his career. He had to make money as a pianist, and it wasn't for another decade, really, that he was able to get around to composing again.
What kind of cuts did he make? I mean, you said that he kept the first version intact, but when he went and revisited it over the course of his career, what kinds of edits did he make?
Well, many people, I think, for quite a while have suspected that his main concern, and certainly the concern if you read his letters, was always about length. So what he was trying to do was make it shorter. I think what's become clear to me is that he actually wrote a very demanding score, not only the piano part. I mean, it's really actually the ensemble and the orchestration. I think orchestral musicians probably know that other of his late works, like the Symphonic Dances, are really, really challenging, very, very difficult to play. And I think looking at it now, and also having now some first-hand experience of how it goes in rehearsal and performance, the bits that he cut in the first instance, I think, were things that maybe weren't successful in the first performance, simply because they were quite difficult. And of course, in 1926, professional orchestras simply aren't of the standard as they are today.
I wondered about that.
And another thing as well is that the original ending of the concerto, which I think is great, has all of these jazz elements in it. Now, of course, for 1926, that was very new. Rhapsody in Blue had only been 2 years earlier, in 1924. The Ravel concerto, which people mention for its jazz references, was not for a few years to come. And yet here's Rachmaninoff asking orchestral musicians to really play very syncopated, offbeat jazz rhythms. And I think for orchestras at the time, they must have looked at it and thought that Rachmaninoff was some sort of alien. And maybe he got comments from people of, you know, we can't do this. And that was one of the first things he cut. And looking at it in detail, the other cuts that he made and changes that he made where he just altered things, I think a lot of them were compromises, especially by the end of his life. You know, to get it heard, the music that he loved that was in there, it might be better to make it just easier.
When I've asked a few people who know, you know, a fair bit about Rachmaninoff, about him, what tends to come up a lot is that you hear these stories over and over again of him being criticised or having a work poorly received and then withdrawing into a depression. And I wondered, as a Rachmaninoff scholar, is that your kind of take on how he responded? Did he take criticism very much to heart?
This has always been the received wisdom, the story. I mean, the most famous reference, of course, is his first symphony, student work, really. I mean, just after student years, which, as the story goes, he didn't write anything for 3 or 4 years, was in depression, and the further part, it's slightly myth, was that he had this hypnotherapy and saying that he'd write a great concerto, and then he turned out the second piano concerto. There's an element of truth in that. But I suppose the overriding thing of that is that he was sort of very sensitive towards criticism. But, do you know, I think it's hard not to be. I mean, you know, he's a very passionate composer in a sense that his music's not removed. It's all very sort of firsthand. I don't think you could write music like that unless you were a little bit sensitive.
Mm. I know that you're a Rachmaninoff scholar, and I want to speak to you about that in a moment. But I also understand that Maestro Ashkenazi is also a, you know, something of a Rachmaninoff specialist. And I wondered, working with him on this concert, you know, has it affected your interpretation of the fourth concerto?
Well, Mr. Ashkenazi is a great lover of Rachmaninoff, and I'm very grateful that because of his passion, I've had a chance to play this here with the orchestra. He brings great love to the music of Rachmaninoff and what he does with it. Has it changed my interpretation? No, I don't think so. He makes things real, and that's important.
Has Maestro Ashkenazi told you which is his favourite version of the concerto?
That's interesting, actually. You see, my idea has been, and I hold to this quite strongly, that the original version is great and that there was nothing really wrong with it that needed changing, and that the reasons why it was changed were because, as I said before, it was difficult. The other point of view is that, you know, maybe Rachmaninoff thought that it wasn't good. And to be honest, there's good things about what he did with the final version. In the 1941 version, he had a great new idea for the ending. And by the way, I mean, that version's 5 minutes shorter, and that's to go back to the climax of the first movement. And a few comments that Mr. Ashkenazi made sort of reflected, and this is a couple of days ago, that, you know, the original version, it's a troubled sort of work. But I don't know, I feel as if maybe I'm changing his mind, perhaps, I don't know.
You're a Rachmaninoff scholar, and you did your PhD on his melodies. How do you think your scholarship has informed your performance of Rachmaninoff?
Oh, it's hard to say. I think they're two different hats. I don't know whether they're interchangeable. Mm. I think, you know, to be a good musician, you need to be knowledgeable about what you're playing. I have an abiding interest in the composer. It wasn't intentional. I was really not into Rachmaninoff much as a younger musician. And
when did you get into him, so to speak?
It was only by chance. I had never planned to do academic study. I don't really see myself as that sort of person. But, you know, when you find yourself with time and people suggest it'd be a good idea to do things, you do. And I was doing a master's degree, and I'd become aware of the original version of this through my teacher then in London. And I was in need of a topic, and I was able to get access to this as then unpublished manuscript. And it just sparked a sort of interest, and I followed through with it.
Thank you. I wanted to ask you about some of the research you did on Rachmaninoff's work when you were doing your PhD that you just mentioned. Where did you travel when you were doing that research?
Look, I didn't travel all that far. I would have loved to have traveled more. But I did manage to go to Russia on two different occasions. The Rachmaninoff archive, I suppose you could say, is split into two. The stuff from before he left Russia in 1917 has pretty much remained there. There's a museum in Moscow, which has most of his stuff. So anybody who wants to do research on Rachmaninoff really needs to try and get in there and look at the manuscripts. The other half is from his time in the West, and that's an archive that he created by donating stuff. And then after his death, his wife donated more stuff. And that's, as I mentioned, in the Library of Congress.
I understand that you found a work of his. How did you come across that?
Yeah, that was quite bizarre. It's only a little piece, a little piano piece, it's been determined. You know, you sort of expect that when people donate stuff to a great library like the Library of Congress, that people would have pored over everything. And when I was doing my research, looking for sketches as I was doing that, there were file references just to bundles of blank pages and things like that. So I thought, well, I should be diligent and go through everything. So I was going through a pile of otherwise blank paper, and I found stuck in between on Russian paper, which is Russian manuscript paper, which I think is interesting, this little piano sketch. And strangely enough, I'd noticed somewhere else just the first couple of bars, which are sort of easy to notice. So immediately I thought, well, this is an idea that he'd developed. It didn't look like any other piece of music that I knew of his. And I was able to make a sort of pencil sketch or copy of what was written down and take it away with me. And when I got back to Australia, I went through it and I realised that if you joined it all together, it made sense as a piece of music. And there was a little sort of flourish at the end. So it made me think, oh, Rachmaninoff must have at one point thought, oh, this is complete. And it's known that just before he left Russia, he was writing a few little piano pieces. I think that this is possibly one of those.
Pre-1917.
Yeah, pre-1917. That's my belief. And what I didn't realise then, but what I discovered more recently, is that one of the little motifs from this little piece did get reused. And strangely enough, it's in the Fourth Piano Concerto. So maybe he realised that this musical idea had another home and therefore didn't take the sketch or the piano piece any further.
During his lifetime, you know, is it fair to say that he was, as a performer, his kind of, that Rachmaninoff as a performer eclipsed Rachmaninoff the composer?
It's funny, I suppose, if you're talking what happened then and what happened or what happens now, I think then there was a period when his fame as a performer was greater than that as a composer. I think most people now know him more as a composer. Some people are surprised these days to listen to his actual recordings. And indeed, it's funny, people see his recordings as being very much old school, whereas for the time, he was a very modern pianist, very faithful to the score, a very interesting pianist.
Was there a tension for him between being a performer and a composer, or between being perceived to be this romantic composer and the modernism that was all around him? Did those forces act on him?
There probably was. As a composer, it's clear that he admitted that he couldn't write in the style of where music was going. For example, in the 30s, he couldn't write atonal music, and he was honest about that. But at the same time, you know, if one looks at those late works, and there's only a few of them, I mean, even like the Rhapsody on the Theme of Paganini or the Third Symphony, you know, they're still very much Rachmaninoff. But they're very of-the-time works. He had really evolved. But there probably was some tension about that. But look, at the same time, he was a very, very humble man. He was very grateful for the opportunities that he had, and I think he simply went about his business and was a very friendly, generous person.
Thank you.
We're very lucky in that we have a lot of recordings of Rachmaninoff, so you can hear how he interpreted his own works. And I wonder, for you as a pianist, you know, how open to interpretation are his works for you, or do they need to be played as he wrote them and as he played them?
I think that's one of the things that we can be grateful for. I mean, they can be played in so many different ways. As an example, there was the Top 100 Piano series where I was in this room talking about Marta Argerich's brilliant recording, and a listener contacted the station to say how much they hated the recording and too many liberties were taken and things like that. But, you know, there's also excitement. And it's interesting, I think, and a great benefit for pianists that you can listen to what he did with it. I mean, interestingly enough, with the second piano concerto, his own second piano concerto, he recorded it twice, a few years apart. And what is interesting is that both recordings are almost identical in the sense of where he takes time, how he creates phrases. So clearly for the composer, he had a definitive way of playing the composition. And we can listen to that and we can think, well, that's what he meant. But at the same time, I mean, there's no secret police out there that are going to sort of jump up on stage and say, you can't do that. You can do whatever you want, I suppose.
What are the elements of pianism that you need to bring to the performance? I mean, what else do you need to bring on top of great technique to make Rachmaninoff really good?
That's another thing, I suppose, that could be contentious as well. For me, Rachmaninoff's music shouldn't be too heart on sleeve. Some people play his music in a very pulled about sort of way. I think there's always an element of subtlety to his music that if you overplay it, you sort of run the risk of sort of undermining it. But at the same time, people have an expectation about Rachmaninoff's music. You know, for playing a concerto like this one with orchestra, people have an expectation that you need to be sort of titanic somehow, you know, that you have to be almost gladiatorial and very, very strong and creating that sort of sound that people expect. Whether or not it's really authentic, I mean, there's the Russian sort of style of playing Rachmaninoff, which, you know, if you listen to Rachmaninoff's recordings, is not really very much like Rachmaninoff at all, but I suppose there's expectations.